Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and today we're going to talk folklore. We're going to talk with the presenter of the 2026 Fife Honor Lecture at Utah State University, and that is Professor Catherine Borland of Ohio State University's Center for Folklore Studies. In her talk yesterday, titled Beyond the Monologue, Storytelling as Collaborative World-Making, Catherine Borland focused on miracle narratives. She says that the miracle and its corollary, the curse, conjure alternative worlds embedded in the everyday. Professor Borland studies and teaches about the artfulness of the ordinary life, and her areas of expertise include feminist oral narrative, festival and dance, and environmental humanities. Catherine Borland, such a pleasure to welcome you in. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah.
Glad to have you in for the Fife lecture. We want to talk about that. I'd like to start with your areas that you focus on in folklore. I was watching a video that you did, like a 3-minute thing, where you talked about how you got into folklore.
Right.
I wonder if you could tell us that story. That was fascinating to me.
Yeah, I'm very much an accidental folklorist. So, and I think that's true of many people who find themselves in the field. Because it's not a discipline like English or history that people know about in high school and are more familiar with. And so I happened to be in an English department pursuing a PhD, and I had a little falling out with my director and went home to an apartment that I shared with a young woman who had just graduated with an art history degree. And as I was complaining about English and studying dead white men that nobody else read, she handed me a pamphlet. And she said, here, you might be interested in this program. And it happened to be the Folklore Institute at Indiana University. So I sat down that night and I wrote my application. And 6 months later, I was in Bloomington, Indiana, a place I had never heard of before. And I walked into my first class having really no idea what folklore really was, and or the study of folklore. And within a few weeks, I realized I was exactly where I needed to be. So just very serendipitous. I'm glad it worked out that way.
you've just retired.
I just retired January 16th from Ohio State University.
Yeah, so yeah. You're emeritus, I guess?
Yes.
Yeah, at this point, yeah. So what are you doing now? Keeping hand in folklore or doing other things?
The Fife Lecture,
the Fife
for instance,
Lecture. There you go.
Which was a great honor. I'm very thankful that they thought of me. And I will be going to Iceland in the summer for the International Society for Folk Narrative Research that's in June. So I'm going to keep my hand in. But I'm also training to be an outdoor expeditions leader for the Sierra Club. And I have a dance form that I practice. So I'm very interested in keeping active and busy with those outside interests.
Yeah. So you're going to be leading hikes then? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah. Backpacking.
Yeah. Backpacking trips. Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Wonderful. Hope you'll be able to get out in some of our country while you're here.
Yes. Yes. Actually, I'm planning to use your mountains for my training.
Oh, good.
I'm also going to be hiking the Long Trail in Vermont in September, which is a 272-mile trail that goes from the border with Canada to the border with Massachusetts. And it's purported to be the model for the Appalachian Trail. So it's older than the Appalachian Trail. And I think whoever it was that designed that trail looked to the Long Trail as their model.
Yeah. So, 240 miles, that's long. I guess that's
272.
272, yeah. Now, so I'm reading here, feminist oral narrative, festival and dance, environmental humanities, because several areas that you've been focusing on.
Yes, yes. I like to follow my nose and see where it leads me.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your talk that you gave yesterday, the Fife Honor Lecture, which honors the Fifes, of course, which who collected so many stories and narratives, and those are archived in special collections here at Utah State University. So beyond the monologue, storytelling as collaborative world-making, and you, in your talk, you talked about miracles and curses. Tell me a little bit about this.
Right. Yeah, well, the miracles and curses come from the examples that I was using in my talk, but the talk was sort of centered around this idea that storytelling is often imagined as a kind of monologue, and the linguists say it's an extended turn at talk, right? But when you look at storytelling events, there are many different dynamics that happen in those events, and it's often people are trading stories. So we have a lot of traditions in folklore that would be categorized as verbal dueling, kind of competitive back and forth, improvisational poetry, and sometimes it's song. But in storytelling, often it's a more collaborative kind of idea. Someone will tell a story, and a listener will then say, oh, that reminds me of something. And the story that they tell then, which is called the second story or the follow-on story, in a sense, it doesn't repeat what the first story has established. Instead, it kind of takes another perspective on the material at hand. And in my examples, I started with a personal experience narrative that was about a miracle that occurred to me during my fieldwork in Nicaragua, which is in Central America, way back in 1991. And I had told this story in 2016 to some people I met at a cafe in Dubrovnik, Croatia. They happened to be from Ireland. So I told my story of a miracle, and it was about while I was on. Should I tell my story?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, I'm going to tell an abbreviated version because it can get long. But the gist of it is I was in Nicaragua. I was doing field work. It is a very Catholic community. And so I was studying how people organized their lives around what we would call folk religious practices, their festivals, their dances, their just a wealth of different kinds of activities that were going on. And I had gone out to a little place called El Atillo, which is a rural settlement outside of the town. And I was using a bicycle. So I was on these very sandy, rutted roads on my bicycle. I did my interview with the gentleman at the house, and I was returning to the town for lunch. And at the time, I wore a hearing aid. As I got on my bike and I started down the hill to get back to the town, there was this very annoying whistle that happened in my ear because of the hearing aid. So I stopped, I took off the hearing aid, and I put it in my pocket. When I got home and walked in for lunch, I reached into my pocket. No hearing aid. And because I could not hear people I wasn't looking at directly, and because I was in a place that was Spanish-speaking, and that's my second language, I was absolutely horrified. This was a major problem that I didn't have this. But the woman of the house said, oh, don't worry. And she pulled out this little print of a saint that I had never heard of, San Pascual Bailón. And it was in this cracked frame. It didn't look like it had been cared for very well, but she set it on the table and she said, "If San Pascual Bailón is the finder of lost things, and if you ask him sincerely to help you and promise to light a candle and do a dance in his honor, he will find your hearing aid." And so I thought to myself, this is the classic researcher's dilemma, because I'm not Catholic. I've never heard of this saint. This is the very first time I'm encountering this. I'm not sure I can believe this, right? But all the people in the household were crowded around me, and they were sure this is going to work. And I was really, really desperate. So I knelt before this print, and I said, San Pasquale Bailon, finder of lost things, if you help me find my hearing aid, which I lost on the road to El Atillo, I promise that I will light a candle and do a dance for you. And then my neighbor, Olivia, grabbed me and said, okay, let's go. And I said, where are we going? And she said, we're going to the market. We're going to catch the bus to El Atillo. So off we go to the market. We get on the back of a pickup truck, which is what buses were at that time in Nicaragua. And we go back up this road. And she says to me as we turn the first corner, she says, is this where you stopped? And I said, no. I looked around. And we went on a little further, and I realized, you know, every corner looks pretty much like the next. Every house is pretty much like the next. There was no way I was going to tell where I had stopped. But about the sixth time she asked me, I realized I was going to be through El Atillo and on to the next comarca. So I said, yeah, I guess it was here. So she banged on the back of the truck. They stopped. We jumped out. And I walked three steps. I kid you not, three steps. And there it was, half buried in the sand. And a mule had stepped on it, so it was broken in three pieces. She said, don't worry. Put it in my pocket. Somehow we got home. I don't remember that part. And somebody gave me a little bottle of nail polish so I could glue the thing back together. We set it aside. And the next morning, I put it in my ear, I turned it on, and it worked.
Wow.
So I lit a candle, and I did a dance for San Pasquale Bailon. So now, 25 years later, I tell this story to the people who I met in this cafe in Croatia. Mm-hmm. And the young woman says to me, she says, oh, isn't it true, the things that happen and you have to believe? And then they told me their story, which was about a friend of theirs back in Ireland named Sean, who was a great carouser. And he was out one night drinking, and he found a ring. And Niamh, Mary's partner, said, and it wasn't any old ring, it was an engagement ring. And Mary said, well, you know, if you find something like that, you have to give it back. It's not right to keep that. But Sean wasn't thinking about that. So Sean, the first thing he did was he went to a pawn shop. He got some money for the ring, a fraction of what it was worth. And he went out the next night for another drinking bout. And something happens. And they told me, and it was very confusing, so I can't really remember. But the point is, Sean is running away from the police. And he comes to one of those old iron gates with the spikes on the top, and he decides, I'm going to jump over that fence. So he does. He jumps over the gate, but he leaves his finger behind.
Ooh.
And Mary looks at me and she says, and do you know which finger it was?
Mm.
It was his ring finger. And then Niamh pulls up the Facebook page, and there is Sean with a whiskey in his right hand and a stump where his ring finger was on the left. So that's the story they told back to me. And in the lecture, I was really talking about the way in which those stories line up. So they're actually mirror opposites of each other in this case, which is really nice. It's a very nice illustration of a principle of second stories, that the second story doesn't repeat the first story. It elaborates, and it kind of amplifies the world, the tale world of that has been established by the first story. And so in this case, not only is a miracle countered by a curse, but we have both stories having to do with walking, traveling along a road, one during the day, the other at night. We have a lost hearing aid. We have a found ring. We have a lost finger in the end of the curse story. So there are ways symbolically that those elements of the stories hook onto each other, right? So they're not the same, but they're in relation. And my argument is that this is a major aspect of storytelling, that collectively, we're collaboratively building this tale world to explore the nature of our reality. In this case, the nature of supernatural intervention into human life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. These are everyday folks, right?
Everyday folklore. People. Yeah.
This isn't a built world fictionally, but this is stories that we tell each other in ordinary life.
All the time. Yeah. Yes. Yes. And some people are better at picking up on the poetics and picking up on where can I hook my experience into your experience. But we all do it, and we all participate in an aesthetic process, a poetics of ordinary conversation.
Yeah. I guess that's what folklore does, ordinary life. Right?
Yeah.
The folk.
Yes.
Right, yeah. So I'm reading in the synopsis for your story that this teaches about the artfulness of ordinary life.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Are there any other examples you might give on the artfulness of ordinary life?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's not just ways of talking. It's also ways of moving and things we make. I'm also very interested in dance, for instance, in the way non-professional dancers can engage in improvisational practices that are very moving and very fulfilling. So I was involved for many years, and still am actually, with a group called the Perennial Movement Group, which is a group of people who, I guess the group is open to anyone over 50 who wants to do improvisational contemporary dance, but most of the members started about 10 years ago in their 70s, so they're now in their 80s and they're going strong. One of the things that one of the teachers in this group, normally the teachers are professional dancers and they're quite a bit younger. One of the things that she said, it was, you know, I may have some technical experience and I may have more flexibility. For example, as you get older, you lose some of your flexibility. But I'm working with people who have decades more life experience than me. And so they can be expressive in ways that are very powerful, right? Everybody, mm-hmm. physical body, can make dance. So that's another example.
Yeah. I'm interested, you're dancing, you're kind of, you have a leader.
Yes.
But you're collaborating with each other.
Yes.
How does that happen? Is that you talk to each other or do you observe each other's movements?
Yeah. Well, in the case of the Perennials, Sarah Ramey, who was the choreographer for this group, the main teacher and choreographer, she follows a practice that was established by a very famous dancer named Liz Lerman, who advocated way back in, I think she started in the 70s or 80s, with this idea of intergenerational dance. The way it works is the choreographer, the person who's kind of creating a piece, will throw out a kind of prompt to the group and then observe people. What would be a prompt? A prompt might be, imagine yourself as a wave in the ocean. What does that look like? People will find some movements, And then the choreographer will look around and see, oh, here's something interesting going on over here with these three dancers. Mm. Let's see if we get everybody to do that. What does that look like? And so it's a kind of back and forth. So the movements are coming from the dancers themselves, but the choreographer is arranging them, changing them, magnifying them, reducing them, trying out one thing or another to find a way into a collective performance. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's interesting to me because, you know, a lot of times we live in our heads.
Yes. Right?
You're talking about being embodied.
Yes.
What does that do for you, participating in this? What does that do for you?
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. I think any kind of physical practice that allows one to improvise activates a kind of body knowledge that in our sedentary lives, we have perhaps let go a little bit. And so if you can really, truly be in your body, and if you can eliminate self-consciousness, right? What does this look like? Let me just move in a certain way. It triggers something. It energizes you. It is also a mental process, but starting with the body, right? And allowing, yes, a kind of body knowledge to come forward. Kids know how to do this, mm-hmm. right, without mm-hmm. even thinking. But as we grow older, I think we become more and more resistant to looking foolish, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Right, yes.
And so that limits us. And so if we can break that down, I think it's a very, very rewarding experience. And the people I was studying and who I still dance with, again, they're now in their 80s and they can go from being on the floor to standing up without some of them, not all of them, but, you know, they have a lot of facility in their bodies that I think if they had not been dancing for the last 10 years, might not be as strong. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So it does that for you as well.
Yeah, yeah. Sure does. Yeah.
I just want to read a line from you did a paper on this. By recognizing barriers to self-expression, they have developed a set of improvisational tools that have been taken up and productively used in multiple social spheres, from factories to refugee camps, community centers, theaters, schools, companies. So I guess these movement techniques right. have been used in very many places.
Right, yeah. And there's also a very famous theater practitioner named Augusto Boal, originally from Brazil. And he does the same thing, starting with the body, starting with gesture, building theatrical pieces that might include also speaking or singing or making noise, but always starting first with what can we do with the body to express a concept, an idea, a problem.
Interesting. Well, let's take a break. We're due for a break. We'll come back with more with Catherine Borland, Professor Emeritus at Ohio State University's Center for Folklore Studies. And she gave the 2026 Fife Honor Lecture yesterday at Utah State University titled Beyond the Monologue, Storytelling as Collaborative World Making. When we come back, we'll hear the voice of Catherine Borland's grandmother.
Yes.
That'll be a treat. We'll talk about a paper she did on that experience and much more following this break.
Jackson, Mississippi guitarist Eddie Cott talks about his gospel roots and mission to bring blues to the world. Then Texas traveling songman guitarist Willis Allen Ramsey in a live set from New Orleans' Chickiwawa Club. It's Blues for Home and Highways on American Roots from PRX.
Tune in Saturday evening at 8 here on UPR.
Mm-hmm. Programming support here on UPR comes from our members and the Wasserman Piano Series, featuring Garrick Olson performing on March 31st at 7:30 p.m. in the Russell Wanless Performance Hall. Tickets and information at wasserman.usu.edu.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with folklorist Catherine Borland of Ohio State University Center for Folklore Studies. Yesterday in the 2026 Fife Honor Lecture at USU, she focused on miracle narratives. She told a fascinating story earlier in the program she gave in that presentation. Before we go forward with this conversation, I want to plug the Goldman Quartet. This is I was able to interview a couple of members of the quartet earlier this week, and we don't have space to broadcast that interview this week or indeed next, but in a couple of weeks you'll hear that fun conversation with the cellist and violist from the Goldman Quartet. Just want to mention you can hear them tonight with the Chamber Music Society of Logan. So go to Chamber Music Society of Logan to get tickets to that event tonight. Goldman Quartet. Just want to make people aware of that. So Catherine Borland, next up, I want to talk about an interesting couple of papers you wrote on an experience you had with your grandmother, Beatrice Hansen. I guess went by B.
Yes.
B. Hansen. Fascinating lady. And in the 80s, you interviewed her on experience, and then you wrote about that, and then she had a reaction to that, and so back and forth, and now you've updated that. So anyway, before we get into all of that, let's hear a piece from this interview from 1986. So what would you like to do to set this up to where we're going to hear this?
Yeah, so the story is about a trip to the racetrack in rural Maine. It's sulky racing, which is with the little wagons, I know, sulkies they're called, on the back of the horse. And my grandmother in, I believe it was the early 1940s, went with her father to the races. And basically they were betting on different horses. And they had an altercation. So just as the horses were sort of vying for authority, the two of them were also vying for authority in the stands with their back and forth. And so as I heard the story, I thought it was a delightful story. My grandmother is a wonderful storyteller, or was. She's deceased now, of course. But and I understood it in the 1980s as a very strong sort of feminist statement because my grandmother wins the contest.
Right.
And when I sent her the paper, she had a very different notion of that and did not appreciate being labeled a feminist. So that was the interpretive conflict that we experienced. But let's listen to, so what we're going to play is the very end of the story when she gets to one up her father.
Yeah. And they're placing bets on different horses, right?
Yeah.
One interesting thing that she explains earlier in the sulky racing, I'm not as familiar with, I've seen it, the horse can't gallop. You got to hold the horse back, right?
Yeah.
Fast as you can, but within the parameters. Anyway, let's hear, this is B. Hansen, interviewed by Catherine Borland. We'll hear just a piece of this.
Father said, "What are you going to do on this one?" I said, "I am betting on my horse. And I'm betting $10 on that horse, because he's going to win." Father had a fit. He had a fit. And he tells everybody 3 miles around in the grandstand what a fool I am, too. He'd say, "Listen to that. Now listen to that. She's going to bet on that horse. You know perfectly well that horse is never going to win. These have been two freak finishes. That's crazy." Well, anyway, he wasn't going to take my money down. So off he and Buzzle went. So young Buzzle turned around and he was grinning. He said, do you want to bet? I said, yes, here's my $10. Go down and put $10 on that horse to win. Which he did. That race, they'd started out exactly the same way. But before they were around the track at one time, the old man's horse was done. He had given his all, and he had nothing more to give. And he simply dropped back and came trailing in half around the track behind everyone. That leaves my horse and Blacklash to really race. I didn't like that too much. But as it turned out, my driver, because of the way the races had been run, had never really had to push his horse. He did this race, and he left Blacklash so far behind that by the time he came under the wire, Blacklash was just about coming around the final curve. And I threw my pocketbook in one direction, and I threw my gloves in another direction, and my scorebook went another direction, and I jumped up and I hollered to everyone, "You see what know-it-all said? That's my father." And finally one man said to my father, "You know, she really enjoys horse racing, doesn't she?" And people around collected up my belongings, got them all back to me, and I pocketed my money. And I had a wonderful time.
And how long did it take your father?
So she's had great success in betting. She bested her father.
Yes, exactly.
He chose the wrong horse. So I think she goes on to say that he wasn't all that thrilled about it.
No.
Her father, right?
He didn't have much to say after that.
Yeah. So before we get into your interpretation, et cetera, the conflicting interpretation, she sounds like quite the person. Strong personality.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
And that accent, where's that from?
Well, she was born in a little village called Brooks, Maine, which is maybe, I don't know, an hour from Belfast. So kind of central Maine. Yeah. And that is where my family is from. They came over in the 1600s and were potato farmers ever since, you know. So, yeah. But she, as a young person, had aspirations to, she wanted to go to college. She was interested in culture and literature, and eventually she became, she had to struggle, but eventually she became a college professor. She had a master's degree in English, and she did a lot of amateur theater. She wrote screenplays, and so she was very interested in dramatizing her early childhood experiences. And
yeah, and a great storyteller, as you said. So her name is Bea Hansen. So you interviewed your grandmother. This was the result here. And then you wrote a paper on it. As you said before, with a feminist lens, that was your interpretation.
Right.
So tell me about that interpretation, and then we'll get to your grandmother's response.
Yeah. So what I saw in this oral version that she gave me was a contest between a father and a daughter. And she sets it up in the very beginning of the story. She says when they get to the grandstand, the seating, they are seated right next to two men, one of which was the lawyer who got her divorce. And so I saw this, and she had told me in earlier conversations and interviews outside of the story itself, she had told me what a struggle it was. She had been married to a man who was an alcoholic and a philanderer. And she had lots of reasons to divorce him, but it was not something that the village approved of. So this would have been late 1930s, I guess. So it wasn't very common. And so I understood that as her dilemma. And then here she is having a success seemed to me, you know, a kind of story about coming into one's own agency. I interpreted that as feminist.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so your original paper was titled, "That's Not What I Said."
Yes.
That'd be your grandmother saying, "That's not what I said," right?
Exactly.
So, what was her response?
Yeah, well, she really very strongly objected to the label. And that was partly, I think, a generational difference that I had not perceived. I just assumed we were on the same page. I was in my 20s. What did I know? And also, what I did not realize is that her father had been her great defender during this very difficult time of her life. And it was really her mother who, in Bee's view, was the evil, you know, character of the family narrative, and who was very judgmental and not a nice person, according to Bee. I never met her mother. But so to have me interpret the story as a conflict between her and her father just did not ring true for her at all. But of course, I didn't have access to that because she hadn't told me that. And I later found out, so this is the second iteration. So I don't know, maybe 20 years, 20, 30 years after the first essay was published, I kind of went back and looked at all the other elements that I could find. Subsequent to this article being published, she did send me a written version of this same story that was originally a letter that she had written to her husband, Frank, who was her second husband, who was serving in World War II. So she told him about this day that she had at the races in this letter. And I realized that her first telling was really a story about her second happy marriage, and, you know, her hopefulness moving into this era with Frank, and not really about her disastrous first marriage. So without access to that written version, of course, I couldn't see that. But I did feel like I owed it to my grandmother to rethink the story again now with this additional evidence. I think the bigger point is that we often make interpretations of other people's statements or other people's stories, and it's rather than assuming that we are aligned in our understanding, it's always a good idea to question and say, you know, instead of saying, "Oh, I understand you," to say, "Do I understand you?" To say back to the person what you think you heard so that you give them a chance to say, "Well, actually, no, that's not how I think about it." It doesn't negate the validity of the first interpretation that I made, because the story is the story. Once it's out and once it's recorded on tape, it's, you know, it's there to be interpreted. But in terms of working with living subjects, with human beings, we can't just grab their stories and do with them what we will. I mean, I think it's important ethically to be engaged in dialogue and try to do the best we can to understand each other.
Mm. Well, let's take another break, come back with the final segment with Catherine Borland, who is Professor Emeritus at Ohio State University, folklorist. She gave the 2026 Fife Honor Lecture at Utah State University yesterday. And we're talking about a broad range of things under folklore. Interesting conversation. Appreciate it. Before we go to break, just another plug for the Goldman Quartet. Interviewed them recently. We won't be able to play that back for a couple of weeks, but I want to mention that you can see them tonight. Hear them. They're in town for the Chamber Music Society of Logan's season. And you can get tickets at USU Ticket Office for that performance tonight of the Goldman Quartet. More following this break.
In the late 1860s, two women meet on a stagecoach ranch to be married off to two very different men.
Your husband, He don't seem to got a whole lot to recommend him.
Oh, he suits me fine.
Christ, you're useless. I may just have to kill you.
Abundance by Beth Henley. Next time on LA Theater Works.
Tune in Friday night at 9 here on UPR.
I'm Laura Gelfand, and this week on Eating the Past, I'll be talking about saffron, the world's most expensive spice. It takes between 370 and 470 hours of work to produce a kilo of saffron. Together, we'll explore what makes it so spendy and how to avoid the fake stuff. Tune in to learn more this Sunday at noon on Eating the Past, right before the Splendid Table on your UPR station.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with folklorist Catherine Borland. She gave the Fife Honor Lecture for this year at Utah State University yesterday. And we have a few minutes here in the last segment of the program. I want to turn, Catherine Borland, next to a paper you wrote called Slow Activism and the Cultivation of Environmental Stewardship in Rural Spaces. I guess here you're talking about citizen scientists and citizen folklorists, and what one could teach the other. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and so this work, this article came out of an ongoing project that we had at Ohio State University called the Ohio Field School. And we had this sort of privilege of being able to do long-term field research in southeastern Ohio, which is the Appalachian part of the state. And I think when people think of Appalachia, they think of drug addiction, they think of closed down mines, they think of, you know, an emptying out of possibilities. And what we found instead was people who were very committed to their local environments and were interested not only in combating the stereotypes, but in actually lifting up nature as a resource not to be exploited, but to be celebrated and preserved and conserved. So I was doing work with a watershed group called the Friends of Scioto Brush Creek, which runs into the Scioto River, which runs into the Ohio River, which eventually gets to the Mississippi and the Gulf of Mexico, right? So it's connected. And the point of this essay is to really highlight the ways in which people who are interested in preserving nature and are working in a very conservative, sort of culturally conservative area, need to always privilege the local in the way they go about their work. Because often you'll have environmentalists kind of coming in and saying, oh, we need to, you know, work for nature. But the people who are living there are the enemy rather than potential allies in stewarding the local resources. And so in this particular case, the watershed group decided that instead of trying to get a scenic river designation that would bring all kinds of people from Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati down to this little rural area to like canoe along the river or the creek. I'm sorry, it's a creek. What they wanted to do was make sure that local people understood the value of what they had, because this creek is, the water quality is very good. It is home to some very rare species of fish and the hellbender, which is a giant salamander. So it's a wonderful resource. And so what they did was they started a Scioto Brush Creek Day, and they got every sixth grader in the whole watershed to come down and do hands-on science learning in the creek and, you know, testing the water and catching the fish and measuring how big they were and learning about, you know, riparian corridors that protect the creek from siltification, all of those kinds of things. And so our group went down to kind of work with the Friends of Scioto Brush Creek to find out what their impact had been on the local community over the 20 years in which they had been working. And as we were working with them to learn more about their impact, we were also learning about this technique of starting with education and thinking about the people who live closest to the stream as the natural stewards, not somebody from outside, but the person who has a piece of land there, right? And has a yard and could plant a riparian corridor right there, you know? We called it slow activism because, of course, when you're looking at recuperating nature from things like clear cutting, which is happening down in that area, you have to be patient, right? And it's more important to create the network of stewards than perhaps immediately solve the issues of water quality by, I don't know, blaming people whose sewage systems aren't working properly for the problems, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons why people's septic is maybe not working is because they don't have the finances, right, to do anything about that. So it's not fair to blame them. According to the people we were working with, you know, it's an impoverished area. So let's not blame the poor. Let's see what we can do. How can we make everyone who's living here allies in this project? And in this case, they have been very successful in their work.
Well, yeah, that sounds very interesting. We're at the end of our time here. It's flown by. It's a great conversation. Catherine Borland, a folklorist with Ohio State University, is in town. She gave the Fife Honor Lecture for this year at Utah State University yesterday. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And one more plug for the Goldman Quartet. Interviewed them. You'll hear that conversation in a couple of weeks. They're in town in Logan tonight, 7:30 at the Performance Hall on the USU campus. You get tickets at USU Ticket Office. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
It's one sky, many cultures, and many moons in our home solar system. Skywatcher Leo T with you. Today, let's do a little solar system moon hopping and exploration of our most distant planet. When NASA's New Horizons mission flew past Pluto in 2015, it gave humanity our first up-close glimpse ever of Pluto and its five moons. Surprise! Also a giant pear or heart-shaped depression called Sputnik Planitia, comparable in size to the country of Mexico and dominating one of Pluto's hemispheres. How Sputnik Planitia formed remains unclear, but researchers have painted a picture of its origins. It's possible that a body about the size of Switzerland crashed into Pluto long ago and at a shallow angle. If true, this would also hint at Pluto's interior, what it may look like under its cryogenic surface. We've got a great picture on the Skywatcher website to look at from New Horizons. This close-up image of an equatorial region near the base of Pluto's bright heart-shaped feature shows a mountain range with peaks jutting as high as 11,000 feet above the surface. The mountains on Pluto likely formed more than 100 million years ago, mere youngsters in a 4.5 billion-year-old solar system. This suggests this region, which covers about 1% of Pluto's surface, may still be geologically alive today. Pluto has, once again, five moons in order from the distance from Pluto. They are Charon, Styx, Nix, Kerberos, and Hydra. Charon, the largest, is mutually tidally locked with Pluto and is massive enough that Pluto and Charon are sometimes considered a binary dwarf planet. New Horizons' view of Charon reveals a youthful and varied terrain. Scientists are surprised by the apparent lack of craters. A swath of cliffs and troughs stretching about 600 miles suggests widespread fracturing of Charon's crust, likely a result of internal geological processes. The image also shows a canyon deeper than the Grand Canyon, an estimated 4 to 6 miles deep. And hopping over to Jupiter, Juno over there at Jupiter, that's one of our fine spacecraft out there, checks out Io. It's one of the, well, it's the most volcanic moon in the solar system, and the most volcanic body that we know of. One of the four biggest moons of Jupiter, that Italian astronomer Galileo Galilei discovered it along with Ganymede, Callisto, Europa, and in 1610. This is when this all happened, the Galilean moons, they are. We've learned a lot about these exotic bodies in the past 400 years, thanks to ever-improving telescope views and close-up imagery snapped by voyaging spacecraft like the Voyagers and like NASA's Juno-Jupiter orbiter. Indeed, Juno recently conducted two close flybys, you probably know of Io, the most volcanically active body, again, in the solar system. And it is rich with volcanoes, and they caught a few of them in action. They also got some great close-ups and other data on the 127-mile-long lava lake called Loki Patera. There's an amazing detail showing these crazy islands embedded in the middle of a potentially magma lake rimmed with hot lava. The reflection of our instruments recorded on the lake, parts of Io's surface are as smooth as glass, reminiscent of volcanically created obsidian on Earth. In December 2023, Juno came within about 930 miles of the surface. And since we're out here, let's take the little Sky Watcher spaceship over to Saturn with its rings, which are fun to find in your small telescope, and its moons. NASA is going to deploy another planetary spacecopter after having success with Mars on Perseverance. NASA's Dragonfly mission to Saturn's largest moon, Titan, is on track to launch in July 2028, the space agency confirmed. This highly anticipated decision greenlights the mission team to proceed to final mission design and testing in preparation for the revised launch date. That car-sized Dragonfly, which is being built by Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel, Maryland, will reach Titan in 2034. Also orbiting Saturn, Saturn's ocean moon, Enceladus, may be able to support life. A research team is working out how to detect extraterrestrial cells there. A planetary scientist and astrobiologist who studies ice grains from Enceladus is interested in whether there is life on this or other icy moons and wants to understand how scientists can detect it. On Skywatcher Leo T, it's one sky, many cultures, and this is a story from the Navajo. Traditionally and historically, Navajo refer to themselves as the Diné, meaning the people. Sacred stories passed down from generation to generation tell of earthly and cosmological origins, and of relationships with continuous historical evolution through four worlds, ultimately leading to an emergence that brought the Navajo to their present location. Navajo legends hold that the Thunderbird constellation emerges in the sky and carries all the clouds in his tail and rain under his wings. Thus, when the Thunderbird constellation is shining brightly in the sky, spring has arrived, so the Thunderbird has arrived up there. Credit the Native American mythology cylinder. So intriguing to be alive, look up, look around, and get a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.